is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, May 26, 2023, and today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana, Taylor and Sarah back in Connecticut. And guys, I have a question for you. Think about this for a moment. We have an interview with Spencer Strider that's going to run on today's podcast. He's in the conversation for the best pitcher on the planet, and man... Like, his knowledge of pitching, you can tell, is so detailed. It's part of the reason why he's gotten so great. Give me the topic about the each of you have the most technical knowledge. Like, give me something that you really know, Taylor, that you could describe the level of detail that we heard from Spencer Strider.
This won't surprise anyone, but podcasting. For sure. Sports podcasting. I mean, that it's in my veins right now, man. So I could chop that up, for however long about that.
Okay. Sarah.
Okay. Well, Taylor made it a professional workstation.
Yeah. He kind of went very, he didn't go quite to where I wanted him to go.
Uh-huh. But because go mine, no surprise to anybody, is going to be Taylor Swift.
And for me, I think it's Civil War history. Like, I think that one, I could go completely nerd level. Cause that's, would you agree with me? That's where Spencer Strider went.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The detail was insane for sure.
Nerding out for sure is a great way to put a phrase on this interview here. And it's great. And you know what? It's in line with our previous interviews with Joey Votto and Corbin Carroll, who were just so thorough with their answers and very thoughtful. So, I mean, I love that level of detail that we're digging into here on the podcast.
Yeah, you love that someone loves his job as much as Spencer Strider does. It's, as I say, it's part of what makes him great. All right, we do have Spencer Strider on the mound on Sunday Night Baseball against the Philadelphia Phillies, who started their series last night in Atlanta against the Braves. Top of the fifth inning, the Phillies were losing 4-3. Dylan Dodd trying to get through the fifth.
Here's a swing and a bomb. Way back to right field. This game is tied up. Where will it land? Oh, my, Bryce Harper. With a moonshot just to the left of the chop house. He's tied it up 4-4 on Harper's third home run of the season.
That was Scott Fransky, 94 WIP. The score was 5-5, bottom of the eighth inning, and Brian Snitker inserted Travis d'Arnaud as a pinch hitter for Michael Harris, and it paid off.
Hitters count, bases loaded, 2-0. And he strikes it hard through the left side of base hit. Ozzie will score. And here comes Marcelo Zuna. Throw to the plate, cut off, and it's a 2-RBI base hit. Braves have the lead in the eighth. 7-5 Atlanta.
And they would win this game 8-5. Orioles, Yankees, final game of the series in Yankee Stadium. We heard from Melanie Newman the other day about how there's been this great playoff atmosphere in Yankee Stadium this week. Top of the eighth inning, the Orioles took control.
1-1 pitch. Right field. Judge heading back. He won't get this one. It's out of here. No, off the wall. Off the wall. Two runs have scored. Hayes stops at second.
That from WBAL. After the 3-1 game, Aaron Boone talked about getting ejected again. That's 4 for Booney during the 2023 season.
I went out there pretty calmly after I was thrown out. Again, I should not have been thrown out of that game. I was very calm, didn't do much at all. And then Gooch was holding me back and just telling me, so I didn't need to be restrained. I wasn't, I just, the dismissive attitude and walking away, I took exception to. So I really didn't have to be restrained. I was being restrained. He was keeping in front of me. Nothing bad was going to happen.
So we're going to get some context on the Aaron Boone ejections later on from Sarah Langs. The numbers are going to surprise you for him since it started the 2022 season. The Mets designated catcher Gary Sanchez for assignment. This is 1 week after he was called up by the team. This is because they reinstated catcher Tomas Nido, who had been on the injured list with dry eye syndrome. The Mets played the Cubs on Thursday, and Pete Alonso did it again.
Swung on, lifted, opposite way, right field, Suzuki going back towards the warning track. He looks up, and it's gone! An opposite field, two-run home run for Pete Alonso, number 19.
number 19, and we're in May. He's on a pace right now for a 60 home run season with about 145 RBI off to a great start. The Padres face the Nationals, and in the top of the ninth inning, man, Rougned Odor came through big time for San Diego.
1-0 to Odor. The pitch hit in the air, deep to right field, and down the line. This one is gonna go! A three-run homer! Rougned Odor again! And the Padres are back in front. It's 8-6.
That would be the final score. That sound from 97.3 The Fan. Cardinals and Reds. Nolan Gorman has been on fire of late.
There's a line drive. It's fair down the right field line. Gorman extends his hitting streak. He has a double driving in. Nootbaar, 1-0 Cardinals with two outs in the eighth.
And they would go on to win that game 2-1. That sound from the Cardinals radio network. Rob Manfred spoke with the Associated Press, and he told that news organization that owners may vote on the A's Las Vegas move next month. This is when owners meet, June 13th to 15th in New York. I'm going to be talking about that with Carl Ravitch coming up. And also, we've got Todd Radom giving us this week's Forgotten Field. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, a whole slew of basketball pods are out right now. The Woj pod has emerged here. He's talking to NBA draft analyst Jonathan Givney about pro days, combines, Victor Wembanyama, Brandon Miller versus Scoot Henderson, guys that are rising in stock, sleepers, gems, all that stuff. And then, of course, the Low Post and the Hoop Collective, they'll have episodes later today as Boston inching toward maybe coming back from down 3-0. We'll see. So check all of those out wherever you're listening to this podcast right now and YouTube.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes. The clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch on Baseball Tonight.
Carl Ravitch, play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball, who this weekend, Carl, you will be in Atlanta. We got the Phillies. We got the Braves. We got Spencer Strider on the mound. Pretty exciting to get someone who is probably right now in the conversation for the best pitcher in baseball.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Buster. We did the White Sox, right, our first game, and I remember Dylan Cease, and you were, you know, we all kind of fell in love with what Dylan Cease was doing, and it was really hard, and it was controlled, and we're like, that's going to be one of the best pitchers in baseball. And what happened to me is Spencer Strider and Dylan Cease at their root are very similar. They're power pitchers with some incredible movement. But Strider has been at that level, you know, all year long and has kind of separated himself from somebody who has similar stuff. So there's a lot about Strider that you got to love from his days in college to where he is now and his consistency. And on a staff where Max Fried was the guy, you could certainly make the case that the last 2 years, I go back to that first meeting we had with him in that restaurant with his buddy and the mustache conversation, that he's in the top, you know, top 10% of pitchers in Major League Baseball. We got a treat last weekend with Verlander, who was ridiculously good, and it was a really good pitching matchup. And now we're going to get another guy against, I don't know, I guess kitchen sink for the Philadelphia Phillies.
Yeah. In my conversation with Strider that I had, you know, I mentioned to him that during the course of our hour long prep call yesterday and Zoom call, there was that conversation about how Spencer has just basically decided, look, I'm not going to be the guy who's got the 3-pitch mix or the 4-pitch mix, or in Yu Darvish's case, the 8-pitch mix. And it's pretty clear, you know, how smart he is that he's just decided, look, this is what works for me. I'm going to keep refining these and making them better and better and better. And I thought back to that conversation that we had with him in that restaurant, where I didn't get any hint of that, like this sort of like I'm super smart. There was no pretension in him whatsoever. He, on one hand, he knows his craft so well, and on the other hand, he had this very down to earth guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the way I would portray him. And if you do research on him and you know him a little bit from our meeting and in other meetings and talking to him on the sidelines, there's a depth to him that's not present in all of baseball players. And whether it's his love of music, he is a guy that likes to go out and eat. He's got friends. Look, he's a Seinfeld fan. There's a lot of things about him that when you just sort of take the whole package, you're like, well, I think that's a relatable guy. And yet I know that sometimes relatable guys on those levels, at least when it comes to their craft, maybe not as relatable, because you know, they speak a language. It's Elon Musk in some ways. Like, he's so far out there, but he's able to internalize it to know what he wants. And at some point, if both of those pitches are getting everybody out consistently, why change? Now, will that velocity last, you know, years from now, or will you need to come up with a third pitch? He strikes you as the type who, when the time comes, he'll be able to figure that out.
100%. You know, and he reminds me, part of the understated part of his personality is how competitive he is, which you can see on the mound the other day. Excuse me, he had a tough outing. And he goes back into the dugout and he just erupts. Like, he was so pissed about how he was throwing that night. And he reminds me a little bit of CC Sabathia, where you knew, okay, CC Sabathia breaks in the big leagues. He's a left-hander, he's huge, and he's throwing 97, 98 miles per hour. But that competitiveness drove CC to make changes that he needed to make as he was getting older. And I agree with you. I think Strider's that guy. And the fact that he already, and you'll hear this in this interview, understands that his changeup right now probably could work for him as a third pitch, but he also understands what makes him great. And you and I have been around so many players who, even when they're playing well, they will tinker and tinker and tinker. Mookie Betts, has a reputation for that. Cal Ripken had a reputation for that, being a guy who, even in the best of times, was always thinking that maybe he could do better. Strider seems to have this great understanding of himself and what makes him so good.
Yeah, I can't put myself in his shoes when it comes to being able to get on a mound and dominate major league hitters the way he does. But if there was anything that you could master and recognize against the competition, I'm winning. 90% of the time, his strikeout rate is an obscene number.
40% of the batters he's faced, 42%, he struck out this year.
Yeah, exactly. So, this is the age-old argument. This is why athletes, especially the great ones, are great. They generally push themselves when other people look at them and say, well, why are you changing? Tiger Woods may be the single greatest example of that, because he was such a dominant player at such a young age and decided to go through a number of coaches and swing changes. And you were, you're puzzled by it, but it's that, that's sixth or seventh sense of them that says, I can be better than I am, even though I'm dominating. And I think the great ones, when they are dominating, recognize now's the time to continue to dominate with what works. And when I stop dominating, well, then I have to figure out another way to dominate. And I think that's a very fine line for athletes. If this is working so well, why change it? And when it stops working so well, then be able to make a change. And it's almost like they're kind of holding cards in their back pocket. I don't need to pull that card yet. Look at how dominant I am. So, look, it's a self-awareness too that's really important. And, you know, he clearly has it. And baseball is one of the great sports. I think you would agree. Baseball is one of the great sports where guys can struggle and work their butt off and try different things. And occasionally it really clicks. Brandon Marsh is one of those examples, you know, with the Phillies. Mickey Moniak, who was a Philly, is now sort of seeing some success. Marcell Ozuna this year, all of a sudden, April was awful. And he worked his ass off and he started to hit the ball to right. And May has been terrific. That it is one of those sports where you can immediately see, because while it's a team game, it's all about your individual effort at the plate or on the mound or in the field that separates you. And you can see the fruits of your labor in many cases. And, you know, I think Strider's just sort of waiting there. Well, when I need it, I'll find another one.
Yeah, and to tell the story, you know, that Dana Brown, Alex Anthopoulos, Dana Brown now the general manager of the Astros, used to be the scouting director for the Braves. Alex Anthopoulos, head of baseball ops for the Braves, told me is that going into that draft when they selected Strider, Dana Brown had a great feel for Strider. He was really interested in taking him. The internal debate was, boy, we also like Bryce Elder. So in round four, do we take Bryce Elder or do we take Spencer Strider? And they decide that they're going to make the move on Strider. They land him, and when they get to their fifth round pick, hey, there's Bryce Elder. They loved Spencer's athleticism. Man, that selection paying off in a huge way. It looks like we're going to have Matt Olson on the microphone on Sunday, and we're hoping to get Ronald Acuña Jr. in our game opening interview. That might be with Eduardo Perez. That's the best player in the National League right now, Carl.
Yeah, and it's not really close. There was a great, you know, the great article from Aldo Gonzalez there about Acuña and his mother and the injury and the subsequent depression and anxiety, and I'm never going to be able to be the player I was. And again, he's another example of somebody that needed to take time to recover from this, to deal with the sort of self-defeat that you feel because your legs are now not what they once were, and that explosiveness isn't there. And all of a sudden, you know, he did the Venezuelan Winter League and all the other things he did. And now he feels like he's back. Confidence in baseball is such a fleeting thing. And the fact that he's playing with all of it on, you know, arguably the best team in the National League, when they're all put together, and he's so far ahead. I mean, this is like Trout a few years ago when he would go to the All-Star game. It was like the hardest thing in the world. You go to the All-Star game with every other great player, and yet you still are able to separate yourself. He's on a team that's got Olson, that's got Riley, that's got Albies,
John Murphy.
And yet he's so far. I can see us having this MVP conversation months from now. And one of those conversations, when there are two teammates, it's always, well, they may split the vote. Well, like, he's on a team that's got a handful of guys that could end up in the conversation, and he's not in danger if he keeps himself of splitting any vote. Like, he's so far ahead of everybody. He's a treat. He's great for the sport. He's obviously great for the game. He loves baseball. He's a great story.
Yeah, look, I love analytics, love to dig in the numbers that reflect how players are performing. The one part about analytics that I don't fully never trust is just knowing how players make adjustments, right? The analytics are based on what the player has done to that moment.
But right.
To your point about Strider, to your point about Acuña, that doesn't reflect the alterations, the changes, the adjustments, the improvements that players can make. And we see that time after time after time. Spencer Strider, you know, fourth round pick in the draft. Right now, he's in that conversation for best pitcher on the planet. And I'm curious, from your perspective right now, who would you say is the best pitcher on the planet? You know, whether it's a Shane McClanahan of the Rays, who I think right now probably is the best lefty. Sandy Alcantara last year was the best pitcher in the National League. He's kind of gone down this year. He's taken a step back. Gerrit Cole feels like he's pitching more free. He's pitching with a ton of confidence right now. We went through about a four-year period where it felt like there was no doubt that the answer to that question, best pitcher on the planet, was Jacob deGrom. You know, Justin Verlander held that title for some time. Max Scherzer held that title for some time. Who would you say right now, in your mind, is the best pitcher on the planet?
yeah, one game that I needed to, get an incredible start from it. You know, I don't want to be the victim of recency, but seeing and knowing what he did last year and seeing what he did Sunday night, it feels like Verlander is going to be in that conversation again. You don't win the Cy Young last year and then fall off the map. And he dealt with injury, and now he seems to be back in the form. So I'm not certain why, if there's no regression, he doesn't end up being the most dominant and maybe reliable as far as moving forward now that he's had this injury and he's healthy and he's only getting healthier. I'd probably, Buster, I know it's a small sample size, and I get, Strider, and there's certainly some relievers. But if we're talking starting pitching, I'd probably lean on him. I'd probably lean on Verlander.
I'd probably go McClanahan right now. 11 starts, and he's allowed 14 runs.
Yeah.
He's averaging almost 6 innings per start. He's got a 1.97 ERA, 8-0 record. I know wins and losses don't really.
I think when you said McClanahan as the lefty, it was kind of a given. So I went to the other guy, like who's going to be the best right-handed starter? Because I felt like this was a Strider, Verlander, whoever else conversation. But yeah, no, I mean McClanahan's again. If you the lefty and a guy that you want, he's probably one. But I just am looking at what Verlander did, and I think if he were healthy and coming off the year he did last year, he'd very much be in that NL Cy Young conversation.
So the Braves are playing the Phillies, who I think you would agree with me are one of the teams that might be at that tipping point, right, where they've been disappointing early on, and either they're going to respond and move forward, or they're going to continue to languish. The Blue Jays are in that conversation. They held a team meeting yesterday. Players really unhappy with the performance there. The San Diego Padres held a team meeting last week. They're in that position. Among those teams, which team do you feel like is closer to the precipice?
You mean like falling overboard?
Yeah. In other words, to getting to a point where maybe they're not going to be able to recover.
Yeah. I think it's probably less about the talent on the team as it is about the teams that they play and the division they play in. And I just look at the American League East, and I worry that in spite of playing better, the other teams are better than most in baseball, and it's just going to be really hard to make up ground. I've been bullish. I thought the Phillies were going to be in the World Series, so I'm not giving up on them. We saw last year what happened when they made the managerial change right around this time, and they took off. There's too much talent there. I don't know what Ranger Suarez becomes. Some of my optimism was rooted in Painter delivering because of what he was doing in spring. But I'd probably lean towards Toronto before I would San Diego and Philadelphia. I'll be honest, I can't figure out San Diego. Like I think there's just been some underachieving with Philadelphia, and maybe it takes a while to get things going and they've been hurt. I can't figure out the Padres other than remember when Carl Crawford came over to join the Red Sox and Terry yes. Francona had like this amazing lineup, and you're like, how are they ever going to lose? And it didn't really work out. I don't know. Is that what's happening in San Diego? Cause I don't get it. The team has got way too much talent with really good pitching. And I don't know, they've dealt with Suarez's injury, but I can't figure them out. The other two, I just think the Blue Jays are in a brutal division and those teams aren't going away. And I still have hope with Philadelphia. I don't understand San Diego.
No, I agree with it. And it's so funny. You mentioned that 2012 Red Sox team. That's exactly the team. What was it? 2011. I'm trying to remember. What was it? 2000. Well, anyway,
I thought it was Crawford, even earlier, but
yeah, the first year of Crawford and Gonzalez, you're like, oh my God, that lineup is going to be unbelievable. And it turned out to be a mess. Right.
Yeah.
And they weren't nearly as good as we thought they were going to be. And
that lineup, I remember asking him, Buster, they could literally, I remember having the conversation, you could line up your guys 1 through 9 and then bat at 9, 8, 7, 6 up to 1. It'd be the same. That's how good they were, at least on paper. And it didn't work out. And look, the Padres aren't that deep, but my gosh, like what's going on here? There's something odd, something off.
Yeah, and first and foremost, some of their stars. Soto's had a good series in Washington, but they need more from him and more consistency. And when Manny Machado is healthy, they need him to get back to what he was doing in the past, you know, given the level of investment. I'm with you. I think Toronto is probably the team because of the division. They're 10 and a half games out in the American League East. And here's the surprising part of the Blue Jays to me. You know, a few years ago, we saw that core coming together, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, and he thought, boy, this team is going to be an offensive juggernaut. They're 10th in the big leagues in runs scored, which is not good enough if you're going to be a playoff team in the American League and come out of the American League East.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And I think the recent surge from Aaron Judge reminds everybody that you almost have to temper some of your expectations on a guy like Vlad Guerrero, who's got to prove year in and year out that he's in that same conversation with these game superstars. And I look, he's got all the ability in the world to do that, but you've got to be consistent. And you know who's leading the league in OPS? It's Aaron Judge again. And there are some guys on that list from Toronto, but collectively they're not playing nearly as well as the group should. And you know who I love on that team is Springer. That's a lineup that you look at and you're like, how do you not be top five in runs scored? How do you not bludgeon guys? And maybe it's still the old conversation we've had the last few years is pitching is just so far ahead of hitting. They have the advantage in the American League East. I know that's a balanced schedule now, but a good pitcher is going to beat a good offense. It just happens. And maybe the pitchers are still ahead of them.
And they definitely have to get more out of Alek Manoah, who, you know, an all-star last year who has, shocking. He's one of the worst pitchers in baseball statistically, which I don't think anybody saw that coming after what we saw out of him last year. Two more quick ones before you go. Oakland ballpark situation. Rob Manfred said yesterday that the other owners might vote on, you know, approving the Athletics move to Las Vegas sometime in June. I must say that it still feels like a giant leverage play because when Rob was asked, you know, was the door closed for Oakland? And I'm paraphrasing here. He said, well, you have to ask the mayor of Oakland, who said that, you know, she cut off negotiations. And so it still feels, Carl, like, you know, it's a poker game and maybe John Fisher, the Oakland owner, is holding a 10 in a 2. And he's trying to force the city of Oakland into giving him exactly what he wants, just a little bit more funding, because it wasn't like they were really that far off in terms of getting a final deal in Oakland. I still don't know what to make of this. What about you?
I think my takeaway is that the owner, baseball, you know, the two stadium situations that have just never gotten resolved are Tampa and Oakland. And there's just very little traction, you know, in each of those cities to suggest we got a deal done. While you're right about them being not miles apart, they moved, but I think my guess is the patience and the blueprint, as you suggest, for how baseball teams tend to move from city to city and get ballparks built for them, et cetera, is such that this is the sort of track that Oakland is taking. But I think my understanding is there's a real good chance they end up in Las Vegas. However, if Oakland came back and gave them the deal that they wanted, that it's not a done deal they're going, but I think that the most people, including those in baseball, feel like they're going to end up in Las Vegas. And if not, it certainly makes us all think Las Vegas is the next frontier. I mean, that's where we're going. There's going to be a baseball team in Las Vegas at some point.
And a last one for you. Jeff Passan wrote a great piece the other day. It's on ESPN.com about the electronic strike zone. He went down, watched the games in AAA where they're using this challenge system in half their games where teams get, you know, three challenges per game in a ball strike call that they disagree with. And the other 3 days they're using a pure electronic strike zone. Carl, I don't think there's any doubt the trajectory has baseball headed toward a challenge system. What do you think?
100%. I mean, baseball was on a trajectory to expand playoffs. It happened. Baseball was on a trajectory, given the experiments in minor leagues, to ban a shift, to add a clock, to everything that has been sort of on the radar and used to minor league level. It's, I don't know. Tell me what's been discounted. What's been thrown out versus what's made the cut and eventually made it to Major League Baseball. And look, we've seen our guy Aaron Boone here get thrown out. It feels like Boone gets thrown out every night, and most of that has to do with the strike zone. So it's quite clear that what's left as far as gray area goes is the strike zone. I think the opening of the Pandora box on that one, where I worry, is the limited amount of time you can do it, which I think is mandatory, because you'll have people just, you know, hitting their, I want to look at, like, at some point you got to limit it, but my God, you are absolutely opening up the K zone that we all see, and a ball outside, and you're out of appeals. And that's just going to be another conversation of, like, God, if we can get it right, why aren't we getting it right?
First off, what year would you expect that it's going to happen? And two, on Boone, I thought it was interesting. You know, he gets ejected again last night. He was ejected repeatedly last year. It's almost always about balls and strikes in interpretation. He was asked about, okay, well, are you in favor of the electronic strike zone? He's like, no, I'm not advocating for that. And I feel like I know Boone well enough to know, like, I think he would be more comfortable with a challenge system than a pure electronic strike zone. Plus, he knows the umpires don't want to hear a manager coming out saying, I want the E zone.
Look, I think the challenge thing, having seen it, works really well. But again, I think you're going to get into a place where once we start it, there are going to be many. You know, look, we'll do our game Sunday night, Braves and Phillies, and Ronald Acuna, in his first at bat, you know, uses his appeal, and he's right. And then two innings later, Riley uses it and he's wrong. And then they use another one and you're wrong, and you just run out of them. And in the sixth inning, there's an egregious call, or the eighth inning. And aren't people going to be, oh my God, like, we can get it right. We lost the game because they missed that. And a 3-2 pitch was called ball four when it was a strike and we couldn't appeal it. Like, but that's all part of this, you know, that's part of these introductions and then subsequently some of the amendments and some of the changes. But that would be what I would be interested to see. Okay, how many do you get? And then what happens in the eighth and ninth inning when it's the most important part and you don't have any? And that's, again, that's on the team and that's on the player. But you put yourself in the shoes of a batter and you realize that ball's outside and he called it a strike. But we got to save our appeals. You better be sure, Buster. You better be damn sure if you're going to appeal that you're right.
And that's what Major League Baseball officials saw last year in the first use of the minor leagues, that teams already early on were beginning to strategize with their players, conversations with their players. Look, we understand that you're upset about a strike one call in the first inning, but we need to save those appeals for the eighth and ninth inning when it might be pivotal. All right, Carl, thanks for doing this. I'll see you in Atlanta.
All right, look forward to it. See you, Buster.
Spencer Strider pitches for the Atlanta Braves in this Sunday. He'll be working on Sunday Night Baseball against the Philadelphia Phillies. Spencer, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
All right. So I mentioned it before we got started, a lot of conversation on our prep call about you and your background and how you got to this point. And so David Cone wanted me to ask you, when you finish a start, what are the first thing that you look at, that you evaluate in determining what you were doing in that start?
I guess it depends on the outcomes, sort of the logistics of the game as well. But I try to give myself the remainder of the game, the remainder of that day, to just sort of go through my recovery process and unwind as best I can. And then the next day, I try to pick up sort of the evaluation and the analysis of it. But there's the immediate, like, metrical analysis that I do, just looking at, what about my stuff was different? What trends was I already focused on with my slider or fastball that were continuing or didn't continue? Some of the execution, understanding maybe if I didn't execute a two strike pitch, why didn't that happen? So it's sort of the controllables that are, or the measurables that are controllable for me, is where I spend a lot of my time.
All right. So what are some of those specific numbers in the data points?
Yeah. So recently I've been focused on slider velocity a lot. That pitch is still kind of new to me in a way. As I've given gained more feel for spinning the ball that way. I've understood that I can do a little more with it than I thought I was able to. And so kind of finding what's the sweet spot for that pitch. Should I try to, turn it into two pitches, different things like this. And, what's a feasible task to take on or, in the middle of the season, stuff like that. I mean, those types of things. And then, like I said, have I not executed a certain pitch or based on the metrics of that pitch, based on the situation, based on the specific hitter, what about previous pitches led to not executing a pitch metrically or location wise? It's a complicated process.
Yeah, it's like asking a math professor how to explain a formula, right? In a podcast. When did you start to get interested in data points like that?
I think I always had. I guess as I've experienced more of the game and gained experience, I figured out what's available to me. What I like to think that I always tried to maximize whatever I knew was available to me. When I was in high school, that was limited. Set of resources. And then when I got to college, TrackMan and other things started to become available. And there's a whole new section of baseball and analytics that are now at my disposal. And then obviously that grows as you get closer to the big leagues and makes the big leagues. And, I think that, I don't want to leave any stone unturned in terms of my development and giving myself a chance to succeed. So I kind of dip my toes into, everything.
So I've covered a lot of pitchers through the years who, when presented with numbers like that, some of them almost want to just turn it off. Like it's too much information. For you, what was attractive about it in terms of, and how difficult was that for you to sort through about what mattered and what didn't?
Yeah, I think everything matters a little bit. You can place emphasis on different things and you're not necessarily wrong, but I think that, like I said, every resource and every bit of data is useful in some way. And I think that it's important to sort of isolate that from the competitive mindset of once I'm on the field, none of that matters. I can't control any of that. And my goal is to sort of use all these things and the data resources to prepare myself best that when I turn off my brain and it's just about competing, I've given myself every opportunity and I've sort of utilized that aspect of the game when it was useful to me. But once I'm on the field, it's no longer really a resource. It's more of something that's specific to preparation.
One of the questions that one of our guys asked me to ask you was about your fastball and how you improve your fastball. I was speaking with Alex Stopoulos the other day, and he talked about the effectiveness of that pitch for you and how you refined it. What have been some of the important elements of that?
Yeah, when I got to Clemson, I figured out I had good backspin, and I was able to spin the ball well. And then I got hurt and had the opportunity to sort of tailor my mechanics and just sort of my arsenal to that aspect of myself. And that included increasing my extension, lowering my release height, creating a better vertical approach angle. Obviously improving my velocity, things that kind of help create, I like to talk about like the formula of a pitch, velocity, movement, extension, and release height, and all these kind of things that are measurable, packaged together in an equation essentially to create deception to the hitter. And some guys, add things to movement at the expense of velocity to create a pitch that's deceptive. Other guys do the opposite. I sort of use that time during TJ to try and optimize every part of that equation.
Yeah, and it sounds like that time after you had Tommy John surgery was really useful to you, something almost like a crossroad for you in terms of how you helped yourself get better. If you can walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I touched on it a little bit, just figuring out sort of what my strengths were or what they could be before I got hurt, and then that sort of reset or blank slate enabling me to, from the ground up, sort of move in one direction entirely, not having to worry about competing or being ready every 7 days, 6 days, whatever. It was just sort of a 12-month program of becoming what I thought would be the most effective version of myself. And, you know, that, I think that, that, like I said, I tried to do things that accentuated what I already knew to be my strengths, you know, velocity and spinning the ball well. And then, you know, those things sort of, you know, as I, in doing so, I learned about myself a lot and was able to continue those trends even after, you know, 2020 and into today.
So I've heard that you're a huge baseball fan, and you know this, there are a lot of guys who play who aren't necessarily big fans of the game. When you were growing up, sort of, what was the team you rooted for? Who was your guy? Who were some of the pitchers that really you were drawn to?
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up a Cleveland fan. So, you know, when I first started to, you know, really pay attention to baseball, it was like CC Sabathia, Cliff Lee. And then, Corey Kluber was probably my favorite pitcher. And, you know, watching him when I was in high school, I tried to emulate him a lot and figured out that I didn't do anything similarly to him. So that was sort of counterproductive, but, yeah, I mean, and then even now, like Walker Buehler, Garrett Cole, when I was rehabbing TJ, I spent a lot of time, looking at Garrett Cole and Buehler, even Yu Darvish, guys that, I thought moved really well, that, did things that I could, replicate.
Where do you think that curiosity comes from that you clearly have in terms of information and getting, you know, finding tools that are going to help make you better? When did you start to feel that way as a person?
And working with a sports psychologist recently, I've figured out a lot of it's just kind of the way I'm wired in terms of a reliance on like data and sort of more objective, like tangible concepts. So, you know, I need a lot of justification and a lot of information to make decisions and, sort of feel confident about things. And, like I said, I, you know, being good at baseball and succeeding and winning is probably my number one priority in life. So, I don't want to leave any stone unturned. So I think that everything is a resource and you don't want to buy entirely into one thing at the expense of something else. You kind of need to learn how to use everything as best you can.
So tell me when you felt like you were really beginning to put it all together, where you felt like, boy, you know what? I'm turning a corner here.
I still feel like there's a lot of progress to be made, but you know, I'm very skeptical of, you know, saying I figured anything out or anything like that. But, in 2021, when we sort of had another reset moment in spring training, when I'm obviously still in the minors and just I think I had taken a couple too many steps at once and got ahead of myself, and the player development staff sort of sat me down and said, "Hey, you're good at, you know, one thing right now, and that's throwing a fastball. So let's make that the centerpiece of who you are, and then try to add incrementally to that." And that was what I needed to hear. You know, that's kind of more the process of how I've developed anyways. And so that enabled me to sort of make a lot of jumps quickly. And you know, that's when I felt like, okay, I have confidence that I could, you know, progress at this level and get guys out.
Do you ever have conversations with opposing hitters where they give you some sort of feedback on what they're seeing from, you know, from their perspective, how the ball pops up on them, and what's something that jumped out at you that somebody said to you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm always interested in, you know, watch it. You know, we have obviously a lot of data at our disposal during a game even. So, you know, when a new pitcher comes in or the starter for that day on the opposing team, everybody's trying to understand what's their arsenal, what's their stuff like, what are their biggest weapons, what are their weaknesses. And, you know, I like being a part of those conversations with hitters and trying to get an idea into what they're looking for. And especially against some of the games, you know, better pitchers, especially better relievers, where, you know, they're having to focus on one thing, whether it's velocity or a specific pitch that's elite. You know, what is it that you, you look for? How do you attempt to be successful in these situations? Because obviously I can learn from that to some extent. And, you know, there's no one way to be successful, I think. So it's interesting to hear how, different hitters and, with different experiences and careers have managed to, you know, develop their own plan of attack.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of times when people talk about starting pitchers, they always talk about a 3-pitch mix or a 4-pitch mix. as you know, when you look at the percentage of your usage, you essentially rely heavily on two pitches, even though, you know, I hear from Braves people and the numbers back up that your changeup's pretty good. I'm curious what your thought process is there on focusing on those two pitches.
Yeah, I mean, the changeup's progressing, and it's something that I think I could use less or more. But, you know, there's, like I referred to the sort of the formula of what makes a pitch deceptive. I mean, I put a lot of work into the fastball and making that sort of the centerpiece, being able to pitch with that pitch. It's arguably takes the least amount of effort. It's the most consistent day to day, requires least amount of feel. It's something that I can throw, to a spot more so than the off speed. And it's, if I can make that the centerpiece and keep that the centerpiece of my arsenal and the pitch I use the most, and that it sort of gives me the most have to deal with inconsistency the least with that pitch, for say it one way. So I think the changeup can be utilized more, but the fastball is always going to be what sort of my game is built around.
So Joey Votto, I once did a piece on him, and he's known, I'm sure you know this, that he's known as a very technical hitter. And Jay Bruce is one of his teammates. I asked him, you know, how many conversations you have with Joey? And he's like, we speak completely different languages. And I'm curious for you, who are pitchers, because you are so well-versed in the technical aspects of what you're doing, who are some pitchers that you enjoy speaking with?
Yeah, I mean, everybody on our staff. I don't have a ton of interaction with guys on their teams, just, you know, for obvious reasons, but, Max and I talk about stuff a lot. I spend a lot of time on the bench, obviously in the dugout. So, even hitters like Kevin Pillar is very, interested in sort of the pitcher's mindset and, you know, the analytics of each pitcher and, understanding what we're thinking, sort of how I am with his mindset as a hitter. And, so those conversations are taking place all the time. And, yeah, you know, it's, I think a lot of guys probably think I'm just insane and say a lot of big words, which is usually true. I'm not really that smart. But, there's always a lot of good conversations going on.
Last one. You change your number in the offseason. That's backstory is pretty cool. If you could just tell that for us.
Yeah. So I always wanted to, get into the big leagues and be able to choose your own number. I think it's in some ways it's superficial, but to me, it was just something I was excited about. And so when I was, generously given the opportunity to sign the contract and get to commit to being here for a long period of time, I thought, you know, it was a good opportunity to pick my own number. And I always wore 28 growing up for Corey Kluber and Scott Clemson and Seth Beer, who's one of the greatest college baseball players of all time, had 28. So I couldn't do that. So I went with 29 for John Smoltz. And then, of course, now I play for the Braves. That number's retired. Matt Olson has 28. So both of those numbers were taken. So I thought, well, the other number that has some significance to me that's pitcher-based is 99 for Rick Vaughn. So, and then the other reason is Paul Rabel. I'm a big lacrosse fan. And Paul Rabel's best lacrosse player of all time. He's number 99. It's been cool to see what he's done with the PLL and stuff. So, it was kind of the two reasons I like that number.
All right. Spencer, thanks for taking time to do this. Can't wait to see you pitch on Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit
to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America or all around the world. Todd, how you doing?
Foster, I'm fine, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I asked Carl Ravitch in our segment with him who he considers to be the best pitcher on the planet. He mentioned Justin Verlander. We talked about Shane McClanahan. We had this interview with Spencer Strider. This moment, as a baseball fan, how would you answer that question?
From Shohei Ohtani out there, because things can change in the snap of a finger. And would you go against that guy? I'm not sure you would. So I like to, you buy stocks in anticipation of what the earnings are going to be going forward. Let's just put it that way.
Well, and I, you know, to your point, I mean, when you initially said his name, like, no, he's not as good as, you know, McClanahan. He's not as good as Strider as a pitcher. But to your point, he's also the only guy who can hit a 3-run homer in support of himself.
It's true. And, you know, we've talked about this so many times over the years, and you talk about it every day. The baseball season is such a marathon. And, you know, what seems baked in place at this very moment in time can change tonight. It can change tonight. It can change tomorrow. So if you're going to bet on a horse, we're mixing all our metaphors here, Buster. All the metaphors are out there. Give me something that I feel pretty good putting my money down on. And it's not about today necessarily. We're taking the longer view. How about that, social media? Taking the longer view.
Well, and you say putting the money down, and we're going to find that, we're going to see that play out in the fall when Ohtani gets a deal of over $500 million. So literally, people are going to put their money.
We used to say Brinks truck. Then we got into piece of the franchise. What do we have now, Buster? What's the analogy?
Oh, man. I do this all the time with my kids, by the way, where I'll make some reference, you know, that they'll look at me like, no, that's completely outdated.
Exactly. Right.
Let's get to this week's Forgotten Field.
We're going out west today, Buster. Baseball history, it's chock full of weird ballpark quirks. But today we're going to talk about a venue that seated over 90,000 fans for baseball. Its left field foul pole stood a mere 251 feet from home plate, topped by a 42-foot-high screen, and the deepest part of right center field was a cavernous 440 feet away. The Los Angeles Coliseum served as temporary host to the Dodgers for their first four seasons while they waited for Dodger Stadium to be completed. Opened in 1923, this mammoth stadium has served as host to two Olympiads, the first Super Bowl, an MLB All-Star Game, and one World Series. In 2028, it will become the first venue anywhere to host events for three Summer Olympic Games. When Brooklyn Dodgers owner Walter O'Malley announced plans to shift his team to the West Coast, there were three options available for a temporary venue. Wrigley Field, a small minor league stadium that would later serve as the Angels' first temporary home, the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, and the LA Coliseum. The Cubs' first choice was the Rose Bowl, but talks with city officials broke down. The National League also advised O'Malley that placing a club in Pasadena might open the LA territory to another team who might seek to locate their team there. So that option was discarded. Finally, with opening day drawing closer, in mid-January 1958, the Dodgers proposed a plan to convert the Coliseum to a suitable baseball venue. They paid $600,000 for a two-year lease, that's all, and $300,000 for baseball renovations, and they played their first home game there against their former New York rivals, the newly rechristened San Francisco Giants, on April 18th, 1958. pitchers, Buster. They were unhappy with the Coliseum's odd dimensions. Milwaukee ace Warren Spahn grumbled, proposing a rule change, making it mandatory for a ball to travel at least 300 feet for a home run. Giants pitcher Johnny Antonelli called the left field wall a farce. And LA pitcher Ed Roebuck, commenting on the sheer vastness of the place, said, and I quote, "It looks like Grand Canyon with seats." Sightlines were less than optimal. Some seats were more than 700 feet from home plate. Despite it all, the Dodgers won the World Series, their second season there in 1959. They drew crowds of 90,000 plus for each of their three home games, and the club moved to their sparkling, normally dimensioned new home, Dodger Stadium, in 1962. On March 29th, 2008, the Dodgers celebrated their 50th anniversary in LA with a return to their first home stadium, hosting the defending World Series champion Boston Red Sox in an exhibition game that was played in front of more than 115,000 spectators, a baseball record. They spent $250,000 to construct temporary fencing in left field, dugouts, and a diamond. This time around, left field was a mere 201 feet from home plate, topped off by a mammoth 60-foot-high screen. When Dodgers outfielder Juan Pierre was told of the dimensions, he feared for his safety. "It'll be like 180 feet from the hitters, and those Boston guys, they hit the ball pretty hard," he said. "I might have to wear a cup. How about that?" LA manager Joe Torre utilized a five-man infield, and Red Sox manager Terry Francona said he was just happy that he wasn't pitching or hitting. "Sadly, my little flares would have carried to the left fielder." A fun and nostalgic night was enjoyed by all, however, including future Tampa Bay Rays manager Kevin Cash, who hit a three-run homer for the visitors. Center field at the original Yankee Stadium was almost 500 feet from home plate. Houston's outfield fence featured a sharply sloping hill. Boston has its green monster, but Los Angeles and the LA Coliseum once had the Great Wall of LA, and that is this week's Forgotten Field.
And I think that you would agree with me. It's in the conversation for the worst baseball field ever. Yes? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be. There were really bad baseball fields in the 19th century that we just have no knowledge right of. There are no great photographs that exist. There were basically cow pastures that, you know, with a diamond. Excuse me. But the LA Coliseum is just, it stands out in its sheer weirdness. And again, a temporary situation. But we've talked about, just last week, we talked about Exhibition Stadium, or the week before, in Toronto, with a very strange broker situation there. But the LA Coliseum, really, really weird. And those pictures of the World Series, Buster, you know, it's just like, it's before you and I were born. So we see these images that are very embedded, probably, in our minds. Very, very strange.
Yeah, it's crazy, because you see what happens with the Rockies. You know, I think the Rockies, part of the reason why that they have struggled to have consistent success in their history is because their ballpark and playing at elevation plays such challenges. Those ballparks with weird dimensions can have an impact on team performance. And the idea that the Dodgers, you know, went to the World Series despite the fact they're playing this weird ballpark, that's surprising to me.
Yeah, and one of the surprising things researching this week's segment was the fact that it's January of 1958 and they don't know where they're going to play yet. They have no idea. There's really no ideal baseball specific ballpark that would be great to host their games. So they go in on this mammoth renovation, and that took a lot of work, and they got it done before April, you know, April 15th or whatever that was when they opened up against the Giants. So now we project forward to what an Oakland, Las Vegas athletic situation might look like. Oh. And it's going to be years if and when it ever gets done. 4 months, 3 months, whatever that was.
And, you know, again, get back to the weirdness. I can't even imagine the offensive numbers. You know, we think the Oakland pitching numbers are bad. You wait till they, if in fact, they wind up in Las Vegas. You know, how difficult that would be in terms of the run score. All right, Todd, thanks for doing this. Oh, we got to get this week's quiz.
We have a quiz to do. What are we doing here?
I just saw Sarah Langs just popped up on my Zoom screen. I'm like, oh, I got to wrap. And then I'm like, no, we have to get to this week's quiz. And Sarah's sitting there like, yeah, this is where I've been dominating lately. Go ahead, Todd.
She is on a roll. So here's this week's question. He is the single season all-time home run leader in the history of the Dodgers franchise. Is it A, Cody Bellinger? Is it B, Sean Green? Is it C, Adrian Beltre? Or is it D, Duke Snyder? The all-time single-season home run leader in the history of the Dodgers franchise. Right. Cody Bellinger, Sean Green, Adrian Beltre, or Duke Snyder?
Taylor?
I'll go Duke Snyder.
All right, Sarah?
Can I phone a friend? Can I phone Sarah Lings?
She'd know.
What are you talking about? You just guessed on the letter and you've been winning.
Okay, I'm going to guess C.
Okay, and I'll go Sean Green.
Foster, you break through this week because it was Sean Green who hit 49 home runs in 2001. So congratulations.
Yeah, Sarah Langs would have absolutely, she would have put me on double secret probation if I didn't get that one right. All right, Todd, thanks for doing this.
All right, guys. Good seeing you.
0096. This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great, Buster. How are you?
I'm doing great, although I must say I was laughing yesterday when our old friend Aaron Boone, who worked with us since Sunday Night Baseball and Baseball Tonight, ejected again, and it really does feel like he's taken this next level. You know, I just texted him this morning, hey, you going to catch Bobby Cox? And if I get an answer, I'll relate that. But what are some numbers behind this?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I also laugh every time I see this happen. Again, that has nothing to do with the game or baseball or anything. It just has to do with knowing him. I feel the same way when I see Alex Cora, David Ross, Bruce Bochy getting angry like that as well. But especially Boone, because we know his temperament, how good natured he is, and it's just so funny to see him in that state. So since he became manager, he has 30 ejections. That is the most in the majors of any manager since the start of 2018. And over the last 2 years, he already has 13. So we had 9 last year, and he's up to 4 this year. So, I mean, will he pass Bobby Cox? Probably not, but the pace is certainly something.
So he just answered my text. He sent me a GIF of a young actor saying, no way, Jose. Like, he's like, there's no way he's going to catch Bobby Cox. We'll see how that goes. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three is six.
So I think I said on Monday, if Bryce Miller keeps pitching this way, I'm going to keep coming back with Bryce Miller stats, and here I am again. So in his most recent start, he went 6 innings, allowed 2 hits. So he is the first pitcher since at least 1901 to go at least 6 innings and allow 4 hits or fewer in each of his first 5 appearances. And in all of those games, he has yet to allow more than 5 base runners. That is one outing shy of tying the longest streak of at least 6 innings and 5 or fewer base runners. That record since 1901 is at 6, held by Jacob deGrom, Shane McClanahan, Clayton Kershaw, and Zach Greinke. And again, that's at any point in career. And he's one outing shy of tying that to start his career. He's been outstanding. And I know people are like, oh, he faced the A's. They aren't that great. He's done this in 5 outings. This is not beginner's luck at this point.
Number two is 450.
So last night, Austin Riley had quite the evening with his home run. In a 459-foot home run, which was 113.8 miles an hour off the bat. That's the hardest hit home run he's ever had, and we know he hits the ball hard. And then he comes back, and it's a 458-foot home run, 1 foot shy of the first one. So he was the third player with 2 455-foot home runs in the game, tracked by Statcast, joining Wilson Contreras in 2019 and Trevor Story at Coors Field in 2018. If we lower it to the even 450, then we get Charlie Blackman, also at Coors in 2019.
Number one is 104.
So we have a very sort of Statcasty metric-driven final two numbers here. Yoan Duran we know throws hard, hit a new level on Wednesday. He threw three pitches that were tracked to 104.0 or faster, including a strikeout of poor Casey Schmidt. Rookie, here's a 104-mile-an-hour pitch strikeout to end the game. So he became the fourth pitcher with a 104-mile-an-hour strikeout in the pitch-tracking era, which goes back to 2008. Aroldis Chapman has seven of those. Jordan Hicks has one. And Mauricio Cabrera had one. And even the number of guys to throw 104, that's 104.0. No rounding, nothing. Aroldis Chapman has 66 of those in that pitch tracking error. Jordan Hicks has 12. Yoan Duran with three in that game already ranks third on that list. Then you have Ryan Helsley with two and Mauricio Cabrera, Tyron Guerrero, Camilo Duval, and Neftali Feliz with one each. It's funny because I saw a tweet from someone the other day who happened to meet his family on a plane while the individual was streaming the Twins game. And his little kid, who looks like he's maybe six or seven, says, "Who are you rooting for?" The person says, "Oh, the Twins." And he goes, "My dad's on the Twins. He throws 103 miles an hour." And that's all he said, but it's so obvious who it is. Now he's got to update that and say, "My dad throws 104.
That's awesome. All right. We talked to Spencer Strider in the podcast before, and I asked this question of Carl Ravitch. I asked it of Todd Radom. And you know, I love to put you in impossible situations. Who do you consider in this moment to be the best pitcher on the planet? How would you answer that question today? And as you and I have talked about in the past, that's fluid. Like Dylan Cease threw so great at opening day, you're like, man, he's in that conversation and he's drifted back. So in this moment, who would you consider to be the best pitcher in the planet?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, Spencer Strider is certainly in the conversation. I mean, depends how broad of a context we're going with that planet, because I just told you what Bryce Miller is doing, and I'm starting to wonder if he might be starting the All-Star game as a rookie in his home ballpark. But that's not a whole lot of a context or a whole lot of history for him, obviously. I mean, I always think of Shane McClanahan these days in terms of guys who are currently healthy and pitching. We know what Jacob deGrom can do if he were healthy. We know what he was doing this year, minus opening day. Spencer Strider is absolutely on the list, and I think he adds to it every time he comes out, even this year with maybe not as dominant as last year. He's getting a ton of strikeouts, but I think right now I would go Shane McClanahan, but we'll see.
Yeah, great minds. That's where I landed too. I was nice. Right in this moment, Shane McClanahan, best pitcher on the planet. All right, Sarah, talk to you next week.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Friday. Over the week, though, I have to mention, I went to Yankee Stadium, saw the Orioles win, 8-run, 7th inning. Really enjoyed that. My wife did not. She's not really a sporty gal, but she loves the Yankees and was gloating a whole bunch throughout that game, Buster. And then those jokes just dried up. Don't know what happened there, but good time.
How about you slam dunking on your spouse? Okay. How about that?
Well, let me.
I mean, I'm just going to tell you, as someone who's been divorced, uh-huh. Not a good idea.
Okay. I always take your advice. But I have to say, Buster, you know, we're walking around the stadium. There was a rain delay. And I will commend the Yankees fans. They are not shy. I had multiple people get in my face and yell, "F the Orioles," just right there in my grill. And then what are you going to do? I just kind of shrug it off. But the first one and the most aggressive one, this guy got in my face, said, "F the Orioles." My wife is right behind me. She is cackling. She loved it so much. She loves sassy New Yorkers, as she, you know, can be one. So we had a great time, but I thought it was worth mentioning there.
Yeah, I love the Instagram pictures you had from that night.
It's a good time. Great food there. Great beer options. Got a big old high ally. That was tasty. So let's get in the tweets here. Paul S. at Sports Paul writes in, "I love the pace of play this year. When I'm at the ballpark, I never go wander around the concourse anymore because I miss too much of the game. Does baseball need an intermission to give people a chance to get food and drinks? I kind of felt the same way. I haven't been to a game this season, and once the game started, I didn't leave my seat. So it is a little, you know, a little push and pull there. I don't mind it, but what do you think?
Yeah, there's no chance there'll be an intermission ever with Major League Baseball. It might be in hockey. You know, there is in the NBA. There certainly is in the NFL. They'll never build that into baseball. That would make the old schoolers absolutely lose their minds.
Yeah, Tim Kirkshin, he would implode into a black hole or something. John Lewis at John Aiden Lewis writes in, the new rules have saved the sport with shorter games. They might also consider a 7:30 p.m. playoff start time so that young fans can watch a full World Series game before bedtime.
I think they do on weekends or maybe weeknights, but there are some World Series games start at 7:30, but it'll be cool this year if you actually get, and look, the longer commercial breaks during the World Series, you're probably looking at 2:45 or 3 hours, but a game being over, World Series game being over by 10:15, we have not seen that much in the last 30 years.
I'm kind of sleeping on the playoff games moving a little bit faster because that is, you know, they can drag on at certain points. Dave Olson at D Olson 61 writes, and I've been thinking about these super long 10 plus year contracts lately. Do you think the teams are counting on someone like Bogarts and Trey Turner retiring before the end of their deal and freeing up some of the salary? I feel like there's no chance of that.
No chance. Because basically the player association would tell the player, look, you need to play out the contract. If the team winds up releasing you because of performance, the money's guaranteed. You can't walk away from that. There've been very few instances in which a player has done that. One example of a player doing that, Mark McGwire, after 2001 season, he retired. He felt like he wasn't living up to his contract.
Stewie 1969 writes in, who is your favorite left-handed swing? My current favorite is Rowdy Tellez. What a low effort, sweeping beauty. Whenever he swings, I see a rainbow behind his bat.
I love Yordan Alvarez, who, you know, as Dusty Baker explained this spring when we had him on Sunday Night Baseball, he has such a simple swing. And it's part of the reason why when Alvarez missed so much time in spring training, he was able to come back and be productive right away. The simplicity of his swing and the power in his swing, that to me is the best left-handed one. But the best one all time, there's no doubt, it's Ken Griffey Jr.
Justin Woodwick at Woodwick underscore Justin writes, and hey, Buster, my brother thinks the Rays will be in the World Series, and I think it's definitely possible the way they are playing. What do you think? Can you validate Justin and his brother right now?
I don't know if I would pick them to be in the World Series because the American League playoffs are going to be tough. You would assume that the Rangers are going to be in with that great offense. The Astros, defending champs, there's going to be a toughness, you know, about them as they enter. Look, the American League East teams that are going, the Yankees are playing so well right now. The Orioles are dangerous. I guess the one team I would discount would be whatever teams come out of the American League Central. So I think once you get into the postseason, it's going to be a tough road for Tampa Bay.
Oh, yeah. Last one for the week. Don Irvine writes in, all things considered, who is the best team in baseball right now, the Rays or the Dodgers?
The Rays, by far the most home runs in the big leagues, and they've allowed, I think they're third in fewest home runs allowed. That's pretty remarkable.
All right. There you have it. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter while you're watching games this weekend. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back on we will not be back on Monday, Buster.
Oh, I totally forgot about that. Because, I was going to ask you about that, wow. About taping on my flight back. And, you know, when are we going to work that out? So we'll be back on Tuesday.
Because we respect the summer holidays, Buster. I know you love to work, but everyone needs a day off every once in a while.
It never occurred to me till you just said that was not a possibility. I was already thinking, well, we're going to have to tape at 8 a.m. at the Atlanta airport, leaving there, flying back to Montana. But no. Okay. Well, that settles that.
If you wanted a true look into Buster's psyche right there, there you have it, listeners. But not even considering that Monday's a holiday. There you go.
I always tell the story about growing up as a kid on the dairy farm. The only day that we got off where we didn't have to go to the barn was Christmas morning. Besides that, 365 morning and night.
All right. We'll be back on Tuesday. Thanks, everyone.
That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks to Spencer Strider, to Carl, Sarah, Todd, Sarah, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.